Florida breaks a record, and it's not one to brag about. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, both the state and America see their largest single-day increases in coronavirus cases. We'll discuss this spike and what we need to do to stop the spread. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we'll tell you why Jacksonville could soon get its very own museum dedicated to the local stars of Southern Rock. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. The U.S. just broke its record for the highest coronavirus cases recorded in a single day, with more than 36,000 new positives reported Wednesday, that according to NBC News. Meanwhile, statewide, our Department of Health reports just over 109,000 total cases. That shatters the previous single-day increase. In our area, we have just under 5,000 cases and 113 deaths. Now, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry spoke to reporters yesterday about what's being done to slow the spread of COVID. He said code enforcement officers are going to patrol local bars and restaurants and report any violations of the state's restriction on indoor capacity, and that they might revoke licenses of businesses out of compliance. Here's the mayor.
It is the responsibility of the bar owner to make sure that they're not over the 50% capacity and people aren't in there shoulder to shoulder.
At the same time, the mayor is facing more criticism about a couple of decisions that have been made recently, bringing the Republican convention to town and not calling for a citywide mask ordinance. In fact, more public health leaders are speaking out about both of those moves. Let's talk to two now. We're pleased to welcome Dr. Jeff Goldhagen. He is the former chair of the Duval County Health Department and chairs the pediatrics department at UF Florida College of Medicine in Jacksonville. Dr. Goldhagen, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. And also on the line, Hugh Green. He's the retired CEO of Baptist Health here in Jacksonville. Hugh, good to have you on the show as well.
Thank you, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. How do you feel Jacksonville is doing in reducing the spread of COVID? What are your concerns and questions? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And lots of comments already on our Facebook page. Dr. Goldhagen, let's begin with you. You did used to head up the Duval County Health Department. And so your recent op-ed in the Florida Times Union caught a fair amount of attention, where you expressed your alarm about the Republican National Convention being mounted here in Jacksonville in August. What are your biggest concerns about that?
Well, clearly having the convention here is going to open up our community to people who come from all parts of the country. Who carry the virus, exposing our community to tens of thousands of people. It's the wrong decision to make in the face of a pandemic. The other perspective, which it's not 100% clear, but the expectation is that there'll be no mandate for using masks, no mandate for social distancing, where it's not clear whether there are plans for contact tracing. Those people who are identified with fever or to be at risk for COVID, there's no plans, to my knowledge, of quarantine plans for them. So all the reasons not to have the convention here relate to just basic fundamental public health practice. And it's clearly putting our community at risk. If the decision is not, if we're not able to overturn that decision, then we need immediate plans for public health precautions that include masks, social distancing, and so on, which interestingly are all the reasons why the convention was moved from Charlotte to here.
And did all of these concerns play a role in your boss, Dr. Leon Haley, the CEO of UF Health Jacksonville, stepping down from the local host committee to host the Republican National Convention here? When it was announced that he was named to the host committee, there was a fair bit of consternation that a doctor and a public health official should be seen as signing on to this effort. What about this?
Well, I can't speak for Dr. Haley. He's not only a physician, he's an emergency room physician. So he has all the insights as to what would be appropriate public health practice. And it was his decision. It was his decision to make, and I applaud him for that decision. The other issue, quite frankly, Melissa, is that there's a deafening silence from organized medicine and from public health. We need organized medicine, public health, to step up to the plate and make a statement as to what is appropriate public health policy and what is appropriate medical policy. And Hugh.
Yeah, that tees up Hugh Green. It is instructive to note here that, Hugh, you are the retired CEO of Baptist Health, which I think people can interpret that how they will. I think it means you're able to speak a little more freely about these issues maybe than someone who's an active CEO. Now, on the one hand, Mayor Curry said that they're going to crack down on local businesses that are violating COVID restrictions. But on the other, he's encouraging RNC to come here, and he won't call for a mask ordinance. At the same time, most other large Florida cities have instituted a mask ordinance, Hugh, and St. Augustine is now considering mandating face masks indoors. So you've been speaking out about these data points around COVID on Twitter for a little while now. What are your biggest concerns about all of this for Jacksonville?
Well, Melissa, thank you for pointing out that I'm retired, because obviously my comments are my personal views and not out of Baptist Health. The real issue for me is the need for sound and thoughtful decision-making in the midst of this unprecedented pandemic, and making decisions that are in the best interest of our community. And I recognize the economic arguments for bringing the convention here, but good decision-making always involves making hard calls and balancing the risk and the reward. And I really do believe that the number one priority must always be the health and safety of our community in making these decisions. And I do find it inconsistent that we're going to warn businesses, even potentially remove licenses for not observing the capacity restrictions. There's been a call for masks, even though no mandate. There's been an emphasis on social distancing. Mm-hmm. We're not opening movie theaters and large crowds in those kind of settings. And yet we are inviting, emphasize that we're inviting, tens of thousands of people to our community, as Dr. Goldhagen said, from all over the country, including hotspots. And none of these restrictions apparently are going to apply. And that was actually underscored in a national newspaper today that RNC did not plan for social distancing or wearing masks. And I think we're not going to uninvite the convention now, I think it's safe to say. But I do think in advance, I would call for the fact that we need to establish the restrictions that we're applying otherwise and make sure that they also apply to those who will come to the community. I think it's unfortunate that this is happening, but again, at this point, what we need to do is make sure that the restrictions we're applying to ourselves apply to those mm-hmm. who will be visiting as part of the convention.
Yeah. Dr. Goldhagen, what about, as we discuss all this, we're also getting reports that the data that the state is releasing about the number of ICU cases and even the number of cases overall is being questioned. You're a former county health department chair. What is your response to the growing concern Florida residents have about whether we're even getting an accurate count of coronavirus, both locally and statewide?
Well, frankly, the whole foundation of public health is built on credibility. And whether or not those questions are true or not, they do bring up issues of concern to individuals throughout our community. And the credibility of public health is really at stake. And it reflects the fact that, for the most part, to a great extent, there's been a dismantling of public health statewide, and there's been a dismantling of public health here in our community that has not an aspersion, casting aspersions on the individuals who are in these positions, but it is a policy that now is coming back to really limit our ability to make critical decisions. And it does appear that some of these decisions are being built based on political interest to limit the perspective on the impact of the of the virus on our community here in Jacksonville and across the state. So there's no turning back at this point. Perception is reality, and if the community has a perception that, in fact, this data is not correct, then it will impact our ability to respond.
Hugh Green, you led a large health system in this community for many years. Certainly hospitals in our area are working as hard as they can to treat the sick and to limit the spread of cases. That said, how do you assess the public health response here, whether it comes to testing sites, availability of medication? You know, this is just a critical public health question that we are not only dealing with now, but by the rising rates we're seeing, we're going to be dealing with this for some time. So what should we be doing that we're not doing to better get a handle on this virus?
Well, three quick points. I think the health systems have certainly responded, as one would expect, very positively. They've done a tremendous job in protecting their own staff as well as patients. And without going into the details there, you know, any patient going into surgery, for example, is having COVID testing beforehand, and mask policies are applied, visitations limited. So they've done a very good job and obviously do a good job of the clinical care. I actually think we've had good decision-making in our community with the shutdown, with the restrictions that have been placed up to this point. The governor of North Carolina just imposed a mandatory mask policy today, and I think that is needed in our community. Masks do protect, and I'm disturbed by the lack of masks being worn as I go
so,
out.
So you think we need a city, do you think the mayor should issue a citywide mask ordinance as other large city Florida mayors have done?
I see no reason not to do that, to protect people. We're here to protect the health and safety of the people of this community. And we know masks make a difference in the community spread. The other thing I want to emphasize real quickly, Melissa, is that there has been such a decimation of the public health local public health organization locally. I recall Dr. Goldhagen's days in which he played a vital role in providing guidance during hurricanes and other things. That just doesn't exist now with the way public health has been sort of pulled apart in our community, in our state, and I do wish we had a much stronger and more vocal involvement of public health leadership in the community.
Yeah, you know,
make these kind of decisions.
Dr. Goldhagen, one of the reasons we invited you on today is we cannot get anyone from the health department, really. They're really not commenting on this publicly so much.
Right. Well, the whole system changed so that the autonomy of local health departments have essentially been eliminated, and the systems are run in all 67 counties centrally out of Tallahassee. If there's one thing we know about public health, that it's all local, and when that system is put in place, it eliminated or made much more difficult a local public health response and public health voice. And the transparency that requires and that's required in order to have a credible health system. I'd also like to agree with you, and it's great to hear Hugh's voice. I haven't had that opportunity as much since he's retired, and he has always been a critical voice in the community for public health. That Mayor Curry has done a good job up to this point. The reason why our numbers are lower here than other parts of the state is in part because of his leadership. Now it's not time to step back, but it's time to redouble our efforts under his leadership, which requires his leadership in order to be able to continue to protect our community. And if we are going to have the convention, then it would be good to go into the convention with some solid public health practices that will won't eliminate risk, but will diminish the risk as much as possible.
And by the way, Politico is reporting this morning that a GOP official says it's possible convention attendees in Jacksonville will be asked to sign a disclaimer before they go inside the ViStar Arena. In other words, acknowledging that they could contract COVID if they go into the convention hall and holding the organizers harmless. Let's go to some calls now. It's 549-2937. John in Jacksonville. Hi, John.
Good morning, Ms. Melissa. My comment is this. We shut down our country in the beginning of COVID saying we was going to stop the rise. Now we over 2.3 or 2 million people with it. We got over 100,000 dead. And in the state of Florida, our cases have just been going up. Now, the reason they said they shut it down was to control the virus. But then once the monies that was passed in the unemployment for the people, we all know that the government had been trying to give $15 an hour per the people, where they booked that. So when they did that, all of a sudden, if you notice, your southern states that was led by Republican governors, all of a sudden this push, open up, our economy can't take it, open up. So all of a sudden they just basically told everybody that, listen, we do not care about your health, okay? It's all about the money. And this stuff does not start from the bottom. It trickles down. So we can go step for step and see where the administration has played as if this is not real. Just the other day at his rally, he said, oh, we tested more than anybody in the world. We tested 25 million people. Well, America has 330 million people, okay? So we got to stop playing and really understand that this is about people's health. You cannot rule anybody if you don't have nobody able to go to work.
Yeah, John. Thank you, John. I appreciate those thoughts. That's John calling from Jacksonville. Hugh Green, unfortunately, the reactions people have to this virus and how it's being dealt with have been politicized. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. And in addition to John's comments, here I want to read you this comment from a listener on Facebook. She says, depending on where you stand, the pandemic is either a serious problem or it's a conspiracy that masks don't work. People are inside their own opposing echo chambers. There's no crosstalk and interest on either side for bridging the gap. You know, we try so hard on this program to bring accurate health information to the listeners out there. And it's simply a fact that this is a serious public health issue. Masks and social distancing do work, and that the U.S. has failed at a federal level to institute a widespread comprehensive testing and contact tracing program to slow the spread of this virus. Those are the facts. That said, not everyone is living in that reality. And I'm curious to get your thoughts about that and what that means for public health.
Well, you pointed out that we need to follow the science and the data. And there is no question that masks are an effective tool to stop community spread. Social distancing is essential. That's just really been established by everyone in the medical and scientific community. Now, having said that, I can't explain why people don't understand the importance, the criticality of wearing masks and socially distancing. I really don't understand that. And, I do believe, as Dr. Goldhagen said, that we did flatten the curve. I think the mayor did make good decisions early in what was done. And what happens is, as you gradually reopen, and you have to at some point, one continues to have to monitor the data and what's occurring. We got to a 12.8% positive test rate yesterday. You know, we used to be at 2%, and the mayor was very proud of that, and he should be. Now we see data that is indicating that we've got spread again, and that's why people must take this seriously when they go out into public. But it has become sort of a prideful thing for some to declare that I'm not going to wear a mask. It often is politicized, as you said, and it is disturbing, and we just need to have strong calls from leadership, both state and federal, to wear masks, socially distance, avoid large crowds. Those kind of things have to continue, because we're going to see the kind of spike we've seen as we reopen things if we aren't using those measures we have at our disposal.
Dr. Goldhagen, here's an email from Mike. He says, a law making masks mandatory can't be enforced. It would be pointless. We need to depend on social and peer influence to encourage mask wearing. What's your response to that? The argument that there's no point in mandating it because not everyone will follow it.
Right. Well, I think it's a combination of efforts. I think mandating it is part of it. I think leadership from both the governor on down to the mayor and city council is also part of it. And so it's not about necessarily achieving 100% if that's not possible, but as close as possible to 100%. Look, there are laws against crossing the street in the wrong place. And it's mandated, but it's not always fulfilled. The other issue, which I'd also like to bring up, is that there's a racial issue here. So the convention is in the middle of the African American community. We know that there's disproportionate effect of COVID on the African American community, and so there's a concern that, in fact, we would see differentially increased levels of transmission in the African community, which is an inequity that we can't tolerate. So that's another issue, and we'd love to hear from the African American community and hear their voice. I know the Northeast Florida Medical Society, which is the Society for African American Physicians. I know they're concerned about it as well, and I'd love to hear from organized medicine. As well as public health, their voice in this issue as well.
Speaking of that, here's an email we just received from a physician, Dr. Nancy Stotz. She says she's forming a coalition with several physicians in the area to address our concerns about the convention here in Jacks. They plan to take their concerns to the mayor, begging for a mandatory mask policy now and for all RNC attendees, limiting the number of attendees, and if not, reformatting the event to a more virtual event. She says, we don't believe the mayor or the governor has any bad intentions. However, holding this event will result in fatalities and serious long-term health consequences, especially for our most vulnerable populations. We have good guidelines from the CDC and our own Florida Surgeon General. They need to be adhered to. We need to remember the enemy is the virus, she says. All right, let's go to Bill in Mandarin. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, a series of one-liners. First of all, in this lawsuit issue, the Republicans may get a waiver signed, but has the city get a waiver signed? I don't think so, so it could be subject there. Second thing, you folks in the medical community have not been quite entirely, not dishonest, but complete in your knowledge. This six-foot rule kind of implies that, okay, somebody emits a bug, and it runs to the six-foot line and drops dead like a marathon runner. Actually, it's a 1 second was the time frame that you should be looking at. I could stand next to a person who's got it for a brief time, hold my breath, and after 1 second, the danger has pretty much disappeared. The third thing, I don't understand why we don't look at the South Korean model. It was a pretty kind of iron rule, but look what those folks done. The amazement low number of deaths, the absence of intellectual efforts is absolutely astounding. And one closing point, I'm tired of this my rights crap to not wear a mask. I think the phrase should be used, my irresponsibility to not use a mask. Gosh, thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Bill. Dr. Goldhagen, your thoughts there.
Well, actually, he's right about the six-foot distancing. It actually is the virus can be spread depending upon if a person's coughing or whatever. It can be spread far beyond the 6 feet. And he's absolutely right about South Korea. But what he also needs to be commenting on is the tremendous success that other democracies have had in Western Europe, Italy and Spain being examples of the impact that they've been able to affect, with almost a complete elimination now of COVID transmission. And so their curve looks like a mountain. Ours looks like a high mountain, a plateau, and now another mountain. And so it's really an interesting phenomenon that the U.S., with what we thought was the strongest public health system in the world with our CDC, now is not able to accomplish what other Western democracies have been able to accomplish.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Dr. Jeff Goldhagen, former director of the Duval County Health Department, now chief of pediatrics at U of Health Jax, and Hugh Green, retired CEO of Baptist Health. As we talk about ongoing coronavirus concerns, as both Florida and the nation break single-day case positive records this week, Mariah in Riverside. Mariah, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I just think it's so ironic that we're worried about people coming in for the RNC from other hot spots when the trajectory we're on right now, we're going to be a hot spot by then, and that we're not talking about that, and that the mayor isn't requiring masks is just kind of crazy to me.
Okay. Thank you for that. Hugh, there is so much commentary on our Facebook page about all of this. The RNC, whether or not we need a mask ordinance, people are deeply engaged in these topics in Jacksonville. And we need to note a UNF poll out this week shows a solid majority of Duval County voters don't want the convention to come here. They're very concerned about spread of the virus and also protests that could accompany this large event. Here is just one comment on Facebook from our listeners. Charlie says, because most people are selfish and we don't have good leadership at the top, the economy will be shut down again and it will be worse than the last time. That's what has been in the back of my mind, Hugh, for some time, is as cases keep rising, it seems inevitable that we're going to have to shut down again at a certain point, even though the governor right now is saying no more shutdowns.
Well, I think the key here is monitoring the situation. I've been very interested in watching North Carolina, where they just decided to not move to phase two because the data suggests they're not ready to do that. And to the mandatory mask policy, I was in Asheville last week and was in a store, and the store owner confronted a woman without a mask, and she said she wasn't willing to wear it. And he said, that's fine, but you can't be in my store. I'm not going to expose the other customers and the my staff. Yeah, I'm just going to ask you to leave. So my point is, we're not going to arrest people for not wearing masks. But if there is a community commitment, it begins with declaring masks need to be worn by the leadership, as has occurred in the state of North Carolina. And then it's up to store owners and others to actually, and all of us in terms of peer pressure, to enforce that. I think it does make a difference if there is a mandatory policy and would call for that. I also want to say a real takeaway, Millicent, I just want this not to be missed, is the absence of the voice of public health locally. And we need to pay attention to that in light of this crisis. It was, essentially disassembled and moved to Tallahassee. And we need to not forget that as we move through this. We need to reestablish public health so that that is a voice alongside whatever administration mm-hmm. is in place in the future.
Yeah, Dr. Goldhagen, that's, again, why we turn to you. I also do want to note one strong local voice who we hope to have on this program soon is Duval County School Superintendent Dr. Diana Green. DCPS did come out with its back-to-school plan this week, and it includes a whole range of options and a hybrid model for online learning versus in-class learning for students. And so Dr. Green has certainly emerged as a leader in this city as she tries to deal with all of these issues as well. But, it's going to be an interesting couple of months, to say the least, Dr. Goldhagen, leading up to this event. And as we continue to watch these cases, as I said, the nation broke its one-day record yesterday, and so did Florida yesterday.
All right. Yeah, I'm not sure, Melissa, with all due respect, I use the word interesting. It's going to be a devastating situation to watch, in particular in the context that, in fact, there are things that can be done. We will never eliminate the risk. We learned during the HIV epidemic when we tried to eliminate risk, because that's not possible. But what it's all about is risk reduction. And as Hugh said, it makes a difference whether we have the mandate for the mask, wearing of masks. It makes a difference if we have the leadership. It's not one entity or one policy that will affect the max amount of risk reduction. It's us working with systems and public policies that will make us all as safe as safe can be. And it's devastating to watch our community basically implode with respect to COVID when other communities around the world who've had the appropriate leadership and public health decision-making have done an excellent job in responding. And I should, you know, it's also important to recognize that we had information, we had knowledge more than a month in advance from watching what happened in Western Europe to prepare, and we failed to do so, and we continue to fail. And that results in the loss of life. And also, we haven't spoken about the morbidity that also is attached to this virus. And younger people now who are making up, composing most of the increase, are at less risk for death, but not completely at no risk. And there are very significant repercussions that they may, in fact, experience post-disease as well. I'd just like to make one other statement, although I appreciate the promotion.
I just got an email. You are Chief of Community Pediatrics at UF Health, Jax. Yes. Thank you for that.
Mark Kudak is the chair.
Thank you for that. Dr. Jeff Goldhagen, UF Health, Jax, with us. Hugh Green, retired CEO of Baptist Health. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us today.
And Melissa, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And much more still ahead. Later, we'll tell you how downtown could be getting its very own rock and roll museum. But up next.
Jacksonville is on the right path as it relates to homelessness overall. But there are some really big concerns about the rising number of people who experience unsheltered homelessness.
Especially lately with COVID and unemployment. Up next, a national expert on homelessness casts her eye on Duval. We'll be right back.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Live From Here with Chris Thiele is now on Electro Lounge Radio every Saturday night at 7. Listen on 89.9 HD4, streaming on the WJCT app or on jacksmusic.org. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson.
Together, we host the Florida Roundup, a weekly live statewide call-in show looking at the biggest issues impacting the Sunshine State. If it's making news in Florida, you'll hear it on the Florida Roundup. So join us each Friday at noon, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Welcome back. Well, around the country, rates of homelessness are down around 7%. But here in Jacksonville, the numbers are going the wrong way. Unsheltered homeless rates are up about 20%. In this time of COVID and recession, we're seeing an increased urgency to the issue. The Community Foundation of Northeast Florida asked a nationally ranked expert to look at what we should be doing differently in Duval to get more people out of homelessness. I spoke about it with Barbara Poppy, the executive director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, and she says while Jax has made gains, we still have a lot to do when it comes to getting people housed. Take a listen. Barbara, good to talk to you.
Good to talk with you.
So tell us what you found when it comes to the issue of homelessness and housing instability in Jacksonville.
The first thing is that Jacksonville is on the right path as it relates to homelessness overall, but there are some really big concerns about the rising number of people who experience unsheltered homelessness. And as you know, unsheltered homelessness is the most visible part of those who experience homelessness. So for your community, the impression is probably that homelessness is rising, when in fact, if we look back over a 10-year period of time, there have been substantial reductions in homelessness, most notably among veterans, people in families, those experiencing chronic homelessness. We've seen reductions in that. Really good progress, but it is alarming to see that while across the country, unsheltered homelessness is down by 7%, in your community, it's up by over 20% during that period.
Hmm. So there are still a lot of unmet needs. What are some of the biggest stumbling blocks that you're seeing in Jacksonville to dealing with this more effectively?
The first is there's an underinvestment in the response to homelessness among single adults. There simply is not enough investment in solutions to addressing homelessness, providing access to housing that is connected to services that helps people avoid homelessness, get off the streets, and then stay out of the homelessness assistance. The second is you, like many communities, are in a tight rental market. And so as you've been addressing the rental housing crisis over the last 10 years, most of the investment has not gone into really trying to grow the number of units that are affordable to people who are in entry-level jobs. And, you know, providing, as we would say now, frontline workers are not having access to the new rental housing that's being built in your community. So that's a troubling long-term trend that will need to be reversed as you also invest in providing rental assistance and other supports to help people, as I said, avoid or get out of homelessness.
With this national conversation we're seeing about defunding the police and systemic racism and reexamining the way our tax dollars are spent, does this data show, make an argument in your view that Jacksonville city leadership could be giving a fresh look at how we allocate our tax dollars? Because, of course, homelessness is, we're seeing underinvestment. Other agencies are getting a lot of investment, like our Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, for example. How could the city look at the way it allocates its resources better to deal with these problems in a more humane and a more effective manner?
Well, first, I want to say there are tremendous racial disparities in who experiences homelessness in your community. It's about 60% of people experiencing homelessness are African American, as opposed to just 30% of your population. So they are far more likely to experience homelessness. And the actual resources that the city of Jackson, through its own tax dollars, is investing in the issue of homelessness is actually quite modest. And the private sector, in fact, is investing substantially more resources than your city of Jacksonville. You're also relying on investments from the federal government. So additional investment from the city of Jacksonville into solutions to address homelessness and to address the racial disparities of Black Americans falling more likely into homelessness is critically needed in your community.
All right. Now, there is a task force on homelessness here in Jacksonville and a number of nonprofits that work to reduce or end homelessness. How do you see these groups perhaps better working together in the future and taking a comprehensive look at this issue? What did your research find there?
We did find that there are two different planning tables in your community, a task force and the Continuum of Care Board. They are not well integrated or working collaboratively historically. I have heard that under COVID-19, you've seen those two bodies work together more closely and are doing some really strong work as it relates to the response to COVID-19. On a going forward basis, our recommendation is that the Continuum of Care Board is better organized and is better connected with the funder community, and that there is a funder collaborative that is initiated to bring together all the various types of funding under a single table, so you can really plan strategically across public and private sector as to where funds will be invested, what type of accountabilities there are for providers to receive those funds, but and most importantly, what's the overall direction that your community is going to take We really, in this situation, need to see everyone in the same boat rowing in the same direction. Otherwise, as you know, if we take that analogy that everybody's in different boats and they're all rowing together, you're going to not achieve any real impact to address the critical crisis of unsheltered homelessness in your community. I want to add that having spent time on the streets of your city, meeting people who are directly experiencing homelessness, their situations are quite dire and really demand a human response. And it was quite troubling to find that people couldn't get access to the resources they needed. They felt like they were bounced from place to place, and there wasn't a lot of clear direction on how they could get their problem solved. And the longer they're on the streets, the more the problems kind of mount up. You mentioned earlier a police response. I heard repeatedly from people that they were asked by the police to keep moving along or even arrested or receiving citations. What we know is those type of actions don't get you a solution. They're simply punitive and harmful and actually make it tougher to address homelessness. So we hope your community is at a turning point and will begin to address the racial disparities, adopt more non-punitive practices, and clearly invest in solutions that have been shown to work in other places, but also have worked really well in Jacksonville. There definitely is a strong understanding of what needs to get done. You need to invest in more of the solutions and do that on a collective basis.
I want to thank you for your insights, since you are a nationally regarded expert on homelessness. And thanks for your attention to this issue in Jacksonville. Barbara Poppy, we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Again, Barbara did all that research here in Jacksonville at the behest of the Community Foundation of Northeast Florida. They're leading a COVID relief fund in this area and do other amazing initiatives. You can learn more about the collaborative report highlighting progress and opportunities for supporting Jacksonville's homeless at their website, jaxcf.org. Also input there from the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, the United Way of Northeast Florida, and the Henry Landworth Family Advised Fund, some of the greatest philanthropic folks in this community. And we want to thank them for their attention to this. A quick break, but when we come back, we're going to rock it out a little bit with the Jacksonville Historical Society. Yes, find out why they are planning a national museum in this city devoted to the local stars of Southern rock. Yeah. We'll be right back.
One Florida Clinical Research Consortium invites essential workers in healthcare to join the HERO Registry and share how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted their lives with researchers from the University of Florida and nationwide. Clinical and non-clinical personnel can register online to tell their story at heroesresearch.org, because the best way to thank healthcare heroes is to learn from them. Turner Pest Control. Turner Clean Disinfection Misting Service provides powerful virus protection for businesses and homeowners. More information at turnerpest.com.
Blues Horizon has a new gig. We've packed up our instruments and moved over to WJCT 89.9 HD3 Blues Horizon as part of the Jacksonville Music Experience. Every Sunday night at 8 on WJCT 89.9 HD3.
As institutions everywhere confront structural racism and inequality, medicine is no different. Only 5% of American physicians are Black, which can affect the care Black patients receive.
If you're not understanding the impact of being Black on them and on their mental health, you're doing a disservice to them, and I don't know how you can treat them effectively.
The challenges facing young Black physicians this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The police are expected to protect and serve. Maybe that's why, in addition to being on our streets, many are also in our schools. Now, more and more school districts are cutting ties with law enforcement and looking elsewhere for security. Keeping our kids safe without calling the cops. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, hundreds of you signed up for our first ever weekly newsletter we started this week on the show. Fresh, sparkling midweek updates and ramblings from the FCC team. We blast it out every Wednesday afternoon. It's our What's Good Wednesdays missive. You can sign up for free at WJCT.org. So what might be good, you ask, in this time of pandemic and reception? Well, here's one item that caught our eye this week. PFLAG Jacks has extended its deadline to apply for scholarships this year to July 1st. Anyone in the LGBTQ plus community applying for secondary education, whether it's traditional university or trade school, needs to know that there is money out there to be had, $1,000 scholarships. You just simply need to apply. Here's PFLAG Jacks board chair Jonathan Stem.
It's something that's available to anybody who has a residence in Baker, Clay, Duval, Nassau, and St. John's County, or attending a university in one of those areas. And it's open to any individual that is an out LGBT individual.
So to apply for those scholarships, go to this website, pflagjacks.com/scholarship. You've got until July 1st. Well, here's another great idea. The Jacksonville Historical Society is working to build a new museum dedicated to this city's amazing contributions to the genre of Southern rock, featuring everyone from Lynyrd Skynyrd and the Allman Brothers to Molly Hatchet and the Derek Trucks Band and many more. Mitch Heyman is with the Society. He's on the line. Hi, Mitch.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me on.
It's so good to talk to you, and how exciting is this to hear that you're celebrating Jacksonville's role in creating Southern rock with a new museum and a performance venue. Now, you're doing this in the old Florida Casket Company in the sports complex. Tell us what we're going to see when this is all up and running.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's very exciting, and I might add, long overdue. We certainly agree with the community that there is a deep, rich history regarding music here in Jacksonville, and it doesn't always get acknowledged. There's been talk for a long time about a museum. I've heard it on your show even, and we've been talking about it as well, so we're really excited to finally be launching something like this. The building is massive. It'll have all sorts of spaces in it. We're still working all of that out, but yes, we do envision a exhibition space, of course, dedicated to all types of genres of music. Actually, there's so much music history that's happened here, and also we're hoping to build in, you know, a sort of an intimate sort of performance venue. We'd love to start having local artists and musicians performing there. Really make it a all-inclusive type music experience. There's lots of room for growth from there. We of course want to start a little small, but we think there's a lot of potential there, so we're very excited.
Now, I've said all along, any band that penned the tune Sweet Melissa deserves a museum in its honor. But whether it's the Allman Brothers, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Molly Hatchet, these will all be featured, but you're going to also give some notes to blues, jazz, and country, and just musical history. People are going to learn a lot about this when they come out to this new venue, which is so exciting. You're educating the public in addition to entertaining them, right?
Oh, yes, definitely. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think I haven't even lived in Jacksonville that long. I moved here about 5 years ago, and I've been a musician for 30 some years, long before my archives profession. And the first thing I zeroed in on was all this amazing sort of hidden history in Jacksonville, particularly in La Villa. I'm a big blues fan, and there's just so much, all the way back to the turn of the century, so much amazing history here. So it's all worth talking about, and it's all worth highlighting here. And it's just, Southern rock is a part of that patchwork, but we're hoping to really expand and really dig deep on what's happened in Jacksonville.
Now, you're recording a performance at the Florida Casket Company to launch the project. Actually, today, people can look for that at your YouTube page. Just search The Music of the Allman Brothers and The Birth of Southern Rock. And if they want to be part of this effort, they can just go to your website, jackshistory.org. Mitch, I'm sure there's going to be so much interest.
There has been already. We're really excited about they're just coming out of the woodwork. I think it's going to be a really amazing. And the community really is what's important here. We need that support, and it needs to be a collaborative effort here, and that's what's going to lead to its success, I think.
So, yeah.
The performance is going to be great. It's on Facebook already. You can go to our Facebook page, too, and to YouTube. And I wanted to mention that for sure because you know I'll be performing Melissa, so you'll have to go and check that out.
Got to do it. And if anyone out there has those old concert tickets from Skynyrd or Allman Brothers shows, that kind of thing, you need to get in touch with the Historical Society. All that memorabilia might be on display at this new museum. Mitch Haman with the Jacksonville Historical Society. I've got a song queued up just for you. Thanks again, Mitch.
Thank you so much. Take care.
And we're going to breeze it out now with a little Skynyrd. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Rock on, Duval.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.